Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June the 6th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is John Peterson, and he will be speaking on Judaism at the Crossroads, the first century. Let's listen in.
My name is John Peterson. And the topic for our second session relating to Judaism is Judaism at the Crossroads, the first century. There have been a couple, three times in history when Judaism has really been at the crossroads in terms of where it would go as a religion. One, I suppose, was the 6th century BC, which was actually before the people in the religion became known as Judaism. It was the time of the Babylonian exile. And being defeated by the Babylonians and wiped out and shipped to another country, would they survive, would they return? And some other issues came up. Another one is the beginning of the 19th century, about the 1800s, when in Europe, with the spread of new liberal ideas and movements, the Jews began to come out of the ghettos. And what would happen to them and their traditional religion when they did that and had new freedoms? That raised some new questions. But perhaps the most dynamic and volatile and wide open period for Judaism as a religion, I would say, was probably the first century CE, Common Era, according to the Jewish names of dates. Instead of using BC and AD, Christian designations, they use the same numbers, but BCE before the Common Era and CE the Common Era. So the first century. And a couple things make this a very wide open period. One is the different Jewish religious movements that were prospering and vying for attention and adherence at that time. And we'll look at four. Some are relatively familiar. The Sadducees, Essenes, Pharisees, and Christians. And the second thing that made this such a wide-open period was the impact of the destruction of the temple after the first Roman-Jewish war. The war lasting off and on from 66 to 70, but climaxing in 70 with the destruction of Jerusalem, the sacking and plundering of the temple, and the end of at least some of the traditional religious institutions that they had been following for several hundred years. So, a dynamic period, and so what happens in that period? To review this briefly, what I'd like to do is take some time to look at each of these four religious movements in terms of these topics: social location, beliefs, the impact of 70, meaning the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, and then the genius and accomplishments of the last two, the Pharisees and the Christians, why they survived and how they were able to generate some major religious movements after being kicked out of the land that was holy to them. I might say, in terms of social location, this is a term that historians use now, and to the extent that I understand how the historians use that, what I'm going to include here is brief glances at the name, the early history up until the first century, the social, economic, and political tendencies and leanings of these groups, so we get an understanding of where they're coming from, and then we can go on to what their beliefs were. So, to start, with the Sadducees, And I'll be running through this rather quickly, because this is a tall order. And so there's quite a bit of information, and I'll try to give some highlights, and if you have questions, just ask. In terms of the Sadducees, the name is a Greek version of one of the early priests, Zadok, from the time of David. The origins unknown, but evidently a Zadok line of priests, separate and distinct probably from the Aaron line of priests, that really began to flourish after the war with the Greeks in the second century. There was a big war between the Jews and the Greeks. One Greek ruler, Antiochus Epiphanes, that is alluded to in Daniel, some of you may have heard about, persecuted the Jews, and without getting into all the persecution and everything, even desecrated the temple. The Jews rebelled, and some of the Jews that rebelled were religious Jews and connected to the priestly line, some priestly houses. And from after that time, we have the name of the Sadducees. Their origins may go before that. And this gives us a clue about what the Sadducees are like continuing on into the first century. For a couple centuries, the Sadducees were connected with the priests, and the priests were relatively well-to-do, part of the establishment. Also, some nobles there, and so these people were well off in society. And because they were well off, they had the sense that let's keep the status quo, as most well-off peoples are. Let's not be too revolutionary. Let's not overthrow the apple cart, because to themselves they would say we're on top of the heap. You overturn the apple cart, we might not stay on top. So they tended to be conservative, both politically and religiously. And so in dealings with later peoples, foreign rulers after the time of the Greeks, for instance, the Romans, they would say, let's have good relations with the Romans. And they tended to collaborate with the Romans and say, together we can work this out and rule this people. The Romans is the military authority, we as the local political religious authority. So they did that. In terms of some of their beliefs, the Sadducees accepted as scripture the Pentateuch, the Torah in the narrow sense of the word, not the rest of the Hebrew Bible. And one of the reasons for this is because the main emphasis in the Torah is on the Sinai covenant, on the worship of the Israelites, and on installing the priests as the main leaders of the people. So what we begin to see here is that their beliefs are self-serving. You accept the scripture that mainly supports you. If you include other parts of the Hebrew Bible, then you're installing some other people as legitimate leaders of the people too, like prophets, wise men, and other groups. So they limited it to that. And then they accepted the beliefs that were sanctioned or supported by that. First of all, the temple. The temple was the main place where God comes to meet the people and where they come to worship God. And that's where the priest presided. Also, they were people who believed in free will. There's quite a distinction in these groups about whether will is determined or predestined, or people have free will. And this also was, in a sense, a self-serving belief. Because, look, everyone does what they can with their beliefs, and with their freedom, and you live out your life according to what God has given you. And between the lines, they wouldn't say, but we would probably add for them, we just happened to use our free will well and came out at the top of the heap. And so people have free will and use their free will to determine where they come out. Already I'm starting to inject some cynical comments on where they're at. And I might say, you might check this out. This is not threatening when we talk about another group, but this is true of all groups in terms of their beliefs. Their beliefs are self-serving because they support their own social, economic, political, religious status in society. And sometimes it's easier to see that with other groups. Let's go on. To the Essenes. This is real brief, as you can see, so you may have some other comments. We go to the Essenes, and the Essenes were another group that we can trace back probably to the time of the early 2nd century BCE and the military dispute with Antiochus Epiphanes and the Greeks. The name means the pious ones. These are holy people. And they lived simple, ascetic lives. They were probably artisans, hand workers, farmers, living probably in the southern part of Palestine, south of Jerusalem, shunned some of the big city life. We would say today maybe a back to nature type of living, and very religious. They probably participated in the rebellion against Antiochus and the Greeks, and then afterwards went back to their or developed a simple way of living, but very, very pious, and probably admired by a lot of people, although their lifestyle was probably not one that everyone could accept. And then from what we can reconstruct, and this is quite a bit of scholarly conjecture, and now this is challenged, but let me give some of the traditional view. They became separatists. They broke away from society at large, even though they were partially separated by their simple life and the location where they lived. And the reason for breaking away, a couple of reasons. One is there was a personal dispute between one of their leaders, it looks like, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, if we can connect the Essenes with the Dead Sea Scrolls. There was a personal dispute between one of their leaders, who in the scrolls we would now call know as the Teacher of Righteousness or the Righteous Teacher, if this was one of the early leaders, between him and the high priest in Jerusalem. And it became quite a vicious personal dispute between the two, evidently. And so they made a break with the religious establishment up in Jerusalem to the north, and with the temple, the sacrificial system, and everything going on. And so they decided to have no more to do with that. Evidently, they probably had brought their occasional sacrifices and made pilgrimages to Jerusalem. And the second thing, and maybe part of the reason for this personal dispute, was that they disagreed with the calendar. They thought that the priesthood in Jerusalem had set up the wrong calendar for at least some of the holy days. Now, to us, calendar isn't that big a deal, and it wasn't about Sabbath. I mean, everyone knew the 7 days of the week and followed those and observed the Sabbath. But it was some of the other religious days. Now, on some of the days, especially like Day of Atonement, when you fast and do not work, as well as Passover, some other days, there's nothing wrong with following those rigorous abstinence traditions and laws on other days, that's okay. I mean, you can eat less food and you can not work on other days. But the problem is then on what they thought was the real Day of Atonement and Passover and other days, you're not doing the observances that you should be doing. And so that was impossible for the Essenes to accept. So it looks like, probably not all the Essenes, but some small group of them, especially men, went off into the wilderness to create a holy, separate life. And they said, all the rest of the world, especially all the rest of the Jews, notably the high priest and the priesthood up in Jerusalem, can go to hell. We're not. We may be the only ones, and we think we are, we're the only ones we know of, that are living God's Torah, God's tradition, as God calls us to live. But we will do that. And so they went out into the wilderness to live and to create their holy community. And if they are connected with Qumran, we have there one of the main sites. And then also there were some other communities out in the wilderness. Now, some of their, and so this would have occurred, just to pick a round number, there are various guesses about the actual date and who the high priest may have been and when they went out. But to pick a round number, after the dispute with the Greeks and the war with them and reclaiming the temple in 164, we could say 150 or so. Just a round number. It could have been a little earlier. It could have been considerably later, but to take that time. And so they lived as this holy community, and this, if they're the ones who settled Qumran, there were three periods of settlement from approximately 150 BCE to 68 AD or CE. Some of their beliefs, to run through briefly. One belief was a sense of mystic veneration for the desert and for the wilderness. On the one hand, the life in the wilderness is a life of survival, but that means you've stripped away all the allurements of the city, the urban life, the temptations of Greek culture, other things going on, all those types of problems. So you get away from those. On the other hand, the positive allurement and attraction was the wilderness in their tradition had been a place of revelation where the people had met God. Sinai covenant out in the wilderness, you know, barren, dry wilderness, the only time in their history where the whole people came into the presence of God. And other times of renewal and refreshment meant going out into the wilderness. And this was not desert, not the Arabian desert or like the Sahara desert, but wilderness where life is stripped down to the bare essentials. Another belief was the sense of the sovereignty of God. God runs the whole show, all of history. It's what you might call Calvinist sense of God's sovereignty pushed to the ultimate. And the flip side of that is the deep prevalence of human sin that is so heavy that leads on to another idea, the need for a very disciplined, rigorous, ascetic life. To get away from the tendency that is so heavy on us to sin. Parallel to that is the sense that, and there's no nice, polite, politically correct way to say this today, women are one of the main sources of evil. One of the old religious sexist groups. And so they followed that. And so throughout most of their history, the community was only men and only recruits who would come and join them. And so out in the cemetery, all the burials were male skeletons that have been found, and only on the very edges, a few female skeletons, to indicate that perhaps only in the last period, last few years, they had some women somehow related to the community, and we don't know how. Another thing, well, a belief, a practice that I already mentioned was the ascetic lifestyle. And one of the scrolls, the Manual of Discipline, as it's often mentioned in English, tells about a very rigorous lifestyle, a long probationary period, hard work, small rations of food. People would not even speak unless an elder in the community spoke to them. And so long periods of silence, a real monastic sense of life, pushed almost to the ultimate. And then finally, what we could call an apocalyptic eschatology. Eschatology talking about the end, and apocalyptic meaning bizarre conflagration that would bring the end of the world. Their own vision of Armageddon. And that was described in a scroll that was called The War of the Sons of Light Against the Sons of Darkness. They were the sons of light, the rest of the world the sons of darkness. And the key team, probably referring to the Romans and perhaps some Jews joining them, would meet them in battle, in this final battle, and there are elaborate descriptions of how they would organize their ranks and hold up their banners and everything and be ready for the battle, and then God would wipe out the whole enemy and destroy everyone else. So it was really God's show on the final day of battle. Let's go on to the Pharisees. The Pharisees, the name itself comes from a passive participle that means separated. Everyone agrees on that. Prushim in Hebrew is separated, but there's not real agreement. There's various suggestions of what that means they're separated from. So it could be from the Sadducees and the priesthood. It could be from impure living. It could be Hellenistic lifestyle. It could be from the graft and political corruption in Jerusalem. Various suggestions. But for us, we have a different sense of the meaning of Pharisees, because the Pharisee, the word Pharisee, as you probably, well, what would be a synonym for Pharisee in the popular terminology today? You've heard the term, I'm sure.
Fundamentalist.
Could be fundamentalist, yeah. Sometimes legalist.
Lawyer.
Pardon?
Lawyer, attorney.
Lawyer, attorney, yeah.
Hypocrite,
yeah. The Pharisees are one of the groups that have some of the worst PR in history. The name is one of the worst names you can imagine, and it continues up till today. And so if we pick up the popular image, we get a quite distorted view. The Pharisees were one of the very remarkable and admirable groups in society at that time. They were teachers. One of their main functionaries were rabbis, and the task of the rabbis was to teach the people how to be religious. They drew their adherents from the common people throughout the country. The time of Josephus, about the time of the Roman War, mentioned that there were 6,000 or so Pharisees, or people that designated themselves as Pharisees around the country. And people have taken that number sometimes as an exaggeration, but there seems to be legitimate reason to think that there were probably maybe that many. They were allied with the scribes. The scribes were probably the highly trained Pharisees, really trained in reading, copying, and interpreting the Torah. And the Pharisees were working to provide a way for the common average Jew throughout the country to be religious. And so they had a lot of followers from the working class, the working people, maybe some middle class people, and saying not only the scribes, not only the priests are religious people, we can all be religious. It's kind of an early version of what we might say, the priesthood of all believers. We can all be good practicing religious Jews. In terms of some of the beliefs of the Pharisees, one was the idea of dual Torah that we talked about Monday evening, or I said a few things about. First, there's the written Torah, and that's primarily the Pentateuch, but includes also the prophets and the writings. Then there's the oral Torah. And this was instituted by God through Moses on Mount Sinai and has continued ever since. And this is the work of the rabbis, interpreting the religious tradition and telling us what it means, what God has done, who we are, and how we can live as a people. In other words, giving the basic information that people needed to be religious Jews at that time. So it was a noble, worthy task. And so this was the work of the rabbis, especially noteworthy are the rabbis from the time of Hillel and Shammai, the generation before Jesus, and on, taking it up as really a professional task, instructing the religious Jews on how to live as religious Jews at that time. Some other beliefs. In terms of the free will predestination idea, they took a halfway position between the Sadducees and the Essenes. Not fully accepting free will alone, not accepting divine predestination alone, but saying in their own way, history moves both through God's action and through human action. Which is kind of a neat conception. The idea is things happen in life, especially things that are religious significance, in that we become partners and co-workers with God in shaping life and working out what happens in history. There are some Christian doctrines that might have some problems with that, but their way of saying that is, really goes back to a way before that. What that does is, in a sense, make God's involvement in human life important. It makes our ethical commitment and activity important as well. And so there's some good sides to that. They accepted some of the new ideas that had developed in the last few hundred years since Persian times that the Sadducees did not accept because they only had the Torah, the Pentateuch of Scripture. A couple of the new ideas were the sense of angels and spirits that were active in life. Also the idea of resurrection that probably did not develop until Persian times, including the idea of a Satan. Maybe not as developed as later times, as Christian ideas, but they had that idea. Chuck?
And you're saying since Persian times, and so I'm guessing that that's a way of alluding to this is borrowed from Persian cosmology?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Quite a few are saying that, though, from Persian influence, Zoroastrianism,
yeah.
Which is less known, and some of its ideas less known. Both Jews and then later Christians seem to have picked up some of this, but not all Jews picked it up. This is part of the ferment that was going on in the first century. Which of these foreign influences and not other ideas do we accept? And they may not have labeled them as foreign at that time, but the Sadducees were saying, no, let's hold the brakes on this, let's just go with what's in the Torah. Also, the Pharisees called Jews to a life of purity, not just sacrifice. Let's live as pure Jews. We can live out the life of Torah. We can follow the covenant. We can follow what God called us to do in the Sinai covenant. These rules and regulations, things we are called to do and to not do, are doable as a whole package, and they're a way for us to be religious. Okay, then on to the Christians. And the early Christian movement is probably more familiar to you, and so I'm going to go over this a little bit briefly, but I'm going to do it in a different way. I'd like to give briefly a Jewish view of the early Christian movement. The Jewish view of early Christianity and of the New Testament distinguishes sharply between the roles of Jesus and Paul. Briefly, we can say it or describe it by saying, for the Jewish tradition now, and this has changed over the years, the Jewish tradition in this century, by and large, especially since about the 20s and 30s, Jewish scholars who have investigated the New Testament and Jesus' role and Paul's role have come basically to say that Jesus was a rabbi of one sort or another from the first century, an observant religious Jew, and Paul was the founder of Christianity. Now, to spell that out a little bit, Jesus is seen as playing several roles as a rabbi, perhaps as a miracle worker, perhaps as a healer, as a teacher, and was concerned about Jewish life. His family seemed to be observant. They went to Jerusalem to be enrolled. They brought Jesus evidently to Jerusalem about the time of Bar Mitzvah. Jesus grew up with a religious tradition, and often we see Jesus pitting himself against the Pharisees and scribes and the Jewish tradition, but what is sometimes skipped over is Jesus' own commitment to the Jewish tradition. And so when he heals someone, he tells them, go to the priest and offer the sacrifice prescribed for your healing. And the topics that he talks about are Jewish religious topics. He talks about the Jewish God. He quotes again and again from the Jewish scriptures, both from the Pentateuch as well as from other passages, but many times from the Pentateuch. He talks about the Torah and how we can live by the Torah and what it is to fulfill the Torah. His miracles are really demonstrations of the kingdom of God breaking into human life. His parables are on one of the central Jewish themes that are very significant, the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is likened unto, the lead-in for many of the parables. And so looking at Jesus in terms of how he fits into the religious movements of that day, the best guess, and quite a few are now saying, and I would agree fully, although there may be some nuancing and some shading to do, is that he is probably or was presenting himself as a Pharisee, as perhaps a scribe, but as a teacher and interpreter of the law. And so many of his arguments with the scribes and the Pharisees come over to us now, if we look at it in terms of the Jewish backgrounds, as in-house Pharisaic arguments. The same types of discussions on how to live as religious Jews and follow the Torah that we see in some of the later Jewish rabbinic literature.
Chuck? Let me get this right. Jesus was a Pharisee.
I think so.
Okay. I just wanted to make it
one. Right. Right. So instead of seeing so much contrast between him and the Pharisees, I think we should see him in the stream of Pharisees. Now, whether that's mainstream or side stream, you know, there's going to be quite a few different opinions. And then there are also quite a few that are exploring the possibility of him being with another group and not a Pharisee. Now, to go on. The Jewish view tends to say that Paul becomes the founder of Christianity. And it bases this on a couple things. First, it says, Paul made Jesus into God. Jesus did not claim to be God or divine. There were some titles that Jesus had. Rabbi, yes. Can there be rabbis? There were rabbis then. There have been in the Jewish tradition since then. Messiah? Possible. It's okay, and it's conceivable for a religious, observant Jew, fully Orthodox Jew, and there are a few today, that accept Jesus as the Messiah. That's not a threat. It's not likely. Because they would say, you know, we think basically that the Messiah is still to come. But it's conceivable. But to call Jesus Son of God in any sense other than you can call other people sons or daughters of God, or to call Jesus God, or to have Jesus identify with Yahweh, that is beyond conception for any religious Jews. Because there's a fundamental, qualitative, total gap between God and people. And no person is God. And God did not come down and become a person, the Jewish tradition continues to say.
So there's no incarnational thrust in Jewish religion, no?
No. Not in the sense of God becoming a person. Mm-hmm. In terms of God invading history, relating to people, becoming involved with human life. Yes, in many ways. So the Christian movement, we can divide into different phases. The earliest phase was probably the followers of Jesus that are described in the Gospels. Jesus called followers. We know about the 12. We know about others. And Jesus called these people to follow him and to accept his way of life and to be brought into a new community. And there was a sense of worshiping, of respecting his leadership, following his teachings. But this community is described in the Gospels that were written quite a bit later, maybe the earliest being Mark, possibly at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, 70, which is a good 40 years after Jesus' life and death, and the other Gospels coming from later in the century. The letters of Paul tell a little bit about the Christian movement of that day, but according to the Jewish view, Paul was the one who really founded Christianity, not Jesus. And so how do we get back to this Jesus movement? Well, we know it was largely a Jewish movement. It was, in fact, before Paul's time, it was totally a Jewish movement. And so it was one of the Jewish movements of that day for 25, 30 years or so until Paul started his missionary journey in Greece and perhaps if he went to Rome and began to include Gentiles in the movement. Briefly about the beliefs of the Christians, rather familiar and without going through everything. The Christians, including both Jesus and Paul, accepted the Hebrew scriptures and the Hebrew God. This was their religious tradition. This was their revelation. This was their God. No one then claimed, and no one has claimed since, that they accepted a different God. Some have said that the God of the Old Testament seems to be different than the God of the New Testament, but it's the same God and the same scriptures. Something quite central was that Jesus was the Messiah. And one of the big issues in New Testament research, and this is not my area, but what I do know about it is maybe familiar to you, is that the question of when did the messianic claims begin? Did they go back to Jesus? Did Jesus claim to be the Messiah? Was it, if he did, was it overt and out front and direct, as the Gospel of John seems to hint at, or was it more hidden and indirect and almost an enigma for people to puzzle out, as comes more in the Gospel of Mark? But in any case, this became central quite early in the Jesus movement. And then there's a sense, there's a new era, there's a new community, there's new fellowship, and there's a new meal for this community, centering in Jesus and Jesus' fulfillment of Scripture. Okay, so much for running through the four groups in terms of social location and beliefs. Now, briefly, the impact of 70 and why two of these groups survived and two didn't. 70 was the culmination of continuing persecution by the Romans against the Jewish community, which we don't need to go into, but just to mention briefly. We know the story of the persecution of Herod the Great, and connected with the birth story, and Roman rule in Palestine became heavier and heavier after Herod's time for a couple of reasons. One, because the Jews, as the Old Testament tells us, were a stiff-necked people. It was hard enough for God to begin to rule them, or for them to serve God, but to think of foreign political rulers, it was even harder yet. But also, they were at a far-flung corner of the Roman Empire. And at this far-flung corner, which took a while to get troops and reinforcements, the Romans were concerned about the people beyond the border invading. And so they needed to have a solid, secure, peaceful area where they could govern solidly because of the threat. One of the threats being the Nabataeans down to the south. If you've traveled over there, you may have seen some of the Nabataean fortresses over in Jordan. You go down to Petra, one of their main settlements. And so they were worried about barbarians coming in and threatening their empire. And so the persecutions got worse and worse until finally the Jews revolted, 66 to 70. The first great Jewish Roman war, another one the next century. But this one culminated in the destruction of Jerusalem, the sacking of the temple, and the end of the whole sacrificial system. And in the process, two of these movements lost their reason for existence. First, the Sadducees. If you end the temple activity, the whole sacrificial system, The Sadducees, which was formed as the majority of priests, lost their activity, their work. That doesn't mean that they were necessarily all killed, but their reason for existence and their social status was gone. And so there's, since then, no temple, no sacrifices, and so their religious leadership of the community is gone. Even though they probably didn't want the war to come. They were caught up in it. The Essenes. The Essenes, living out in the wilderness, or at least the people at Qumran, were busy copying their scrolls, living their ascetic lifestyle, and were non-combatants in the war. They were not going to fight unless this was the final battle. And it seems that for a while they didn't think it was the final battle. And so they packed up all their scrolls, 800 or so, put them in the caves right there by Qumran and other communities and other places, and said, we will take off, because when the Romans sent reinforcements in from Damascus. One legion came down the Jordan Valley, down to Jericho, and from their place and from maybe a few of their people out, they knew the Roman legion was coming, and they could be wiped out on a whim. And so they said, let's retreat. Let's leave our valuables, especially our scrolls in the caves, take off for the wilderness, and then maybe we can survive whatever the battle is. After the war, we'll come back, open the caves, take out our scrolls, go back to our standard life. That didn't happen. They were casualties of the war. Some of them, we don't know if all, some of them went to Masada, evidently, and were part of the group there that held out, had some raiding parties go out, and some of them were probably convinced that this may be the final conflagration described in their scroll of the war, Battle of the Sons of Light against the Sons of Darkness. Hit out on Masada, was surrounded by fleet, and followed the lead of their ruler, what's his name now? Can't remember. Anyway. and were wiped out there. And so they were casualties of the war, even though they initially started out from what we can tell as non-combatants. Conscientious objectors and more, unless this was the final battle. So that leaves us with the Pharisees and the Christians, the two groups that did survive the impact of 70 and the destruction of the temple. Now, how did they do it? Basically, they did it because both of them allegorized the meaning of the temple so that their reason for existence and their function in life was not dependent on the life of the temple and the work of the priests and the sacrificial system. So, how did they do it? Well, first the Pharisees. The Pharisees, to give an example of how they did it, said that prayer and a life of purity is just as important as offering the sacrifices in the temple. Now, they weren't fighting against offering sacrifices in the temple. They probably did at times also, but it wasn't absolutely necessary. And so they developed the religious tradition so that every Jew could be religious, could be pure, could be holy. Even at a meal, you can be as holy as the priest offering a sacrifice in the temple. Your table is as holy as the altar. The food that you eat, by the way you eat and not eat, is as holy as a sacrifice in the temple. In other words, you can be a religious, holy, pure Jew just in your eating and in your meal fellowship together as in the temple. So they didn't need the temple. The Jews could do wherever they were. And even if they're kicked out of Palestine, fine. They can be holy elsewhere. And so they allegorized the meaning, the sense of holiness, and were not dependent on the temple and the sacrificial system. The Christians did the same thing. They allegorized the meaning of the temple. Chuck.
So it sounds like the Pharisees turned it into a personal piety rather than
yes.
political piety.
Personal and family.
Okay.
And community, because some of the traditions that they advocated, like kosher eating, to the extent that those began at that time, you couldn't carry out as an individual or even as a family very well.
Right.
But, yeah, it was community related.
So they disconnected themselves in a way from a nation.
Yeah, yeah. They broke with the nation concept. Which becomes very, very significant, also for surviving 70 and the second Jewish-Roman revolt.
Did the concept of a synagogue already exist, or did this?
It already existed. It already existed, but as Susan Briel mentioned in discussion this morning in the Bible study, it took a while for synagogue to convert into the sense of a building. It's just like ecclesia in the New Testament. The term itself, the two Greek terms, mean a gathering and is really focused on the people. In later times, when they had standard places to meet in the Jewish villages and communities, then it came to be related, as time went on, to a building, just like a church. So how did the Christians allegorize the sense of the temple? Three ways, briefly. One is through Jesus. Taking a saying like Jesus, who said, if you destroy this temple in 3 days, I will raise it up. So Jesus' own resurrection, body and resurrection, becomes the living temple among us. Paul talks about the community of believers being the new temple, the new community. And then finally, the book of Hebrews. From my Jewish background and my training and ways of looking at the New Testament, I see six Gospels, not four. We have the standard four, plus Hebrews, which is a gospel related to the temple, and Revelation, an apocalyptic gospel centering in chapter 12 with the birth of the child. Another gospel story, another birth story, but apocalyptic. But in Hebrews, what we have, as a Jewish scholar, Jack Neusner, has pointed out very well, even though he's not a New Testament scholar, is really interpreting Jesus' life in terms of the realities of the temple. And so all the significant roles that were played in the temple to accomplish atonement are carried out by Jesus. Jesus becomes the lamb, the sheep that is slain. Jesus becomes the high priest that offers the sacrifice. And so the realities of the temple are carried out in Jesus' own work and life and are not dependent on the temple itself and on the actual sacrifices. So the Jewish sense of atonement is carried out through the work of Jesus and Jesus' life and death. And so the temple is not necessary because the same religious realities, Jewish realities of working out atonement with God, are worked out in Jesus' life. Chuck?
So this is where in Christian thought, the sacrificial death of Jesus comes in.
Yes. Now, there are various theories of atonement that develop later on,
right,
trying to explain some of the whys and wherefores,
right,
that are later theological discussions.
Right.
And so this really comes a little before that, but it may well be that Hebrews was written in the, you know, the final, or during the Jewish-Roman War, the final half of that war, or shortly after that time, and trying to understand both the meaning of the destruction of the temple on the one hand, and the significance of Jesus' life and death and resurrection on the other hand. Because the imagery, I mean, you see Jesus described in those terms. Okay, then finally, the genius and accomplishments of these two. Briefly to describe those. And first, the Pharisees, four things to mention here. The Pharisees met the main challenges of that time period, meaning of the first century, and actually it goes back to the previous century. Several challenges. One, Hellenism, Greek culture, and Greek ways of thinking and reading texts and of living, which made an impact on Jewish thinking, but they were able to incorporate that into a Jewish framework and not lose their Judaism. Second, Messiahs, not only Jesus, but other messianic claims, especially with the popular expectation. We're looking for a political Messiah, a David, to rally the troops, drive out the Romans, and bring back the kingdom that we knew from before. Persecutions. They were persecuted first by the Greeks, later by the Romans. They outlived those persecutions, and then finally outliving the loss of the temple in 70. Those are several heavy challenges, even over a couple hundred years. And Sadducees and Essenes didn't meet the challenge and were wiped out in the process. A second thing, something very impressive about the Pharisees is that they established a democratic lay movement for all the people. It was a democratic movement, a religion for all people, for all the Jews to be religious. All Jews could be pure, they could be holy, and they could be that in their everyday living and in their homes. A wonderful thing. The Essenes didn't offer that to all the people, neither did the Sadducees. They found ways to make an old revelation relevant to new situations by prayer, by living holy lives, by giving Jews a way of life. And then finally, and perhaps most impressively of all, is that these Pharisees and the continuing rabbinic tradition after them laid the foundations for Judaism to survive in the following centuries, to survive in the diaspora, to survive without their holy city, Jerusalem, not living in their own land, but to go on the road, in effect, and go on the road for hundreds of years, even millennia. And part of the reason they did this is because of some written collections. They finished determining the books of the Bible. So the Revelation, they completed. Second, they developed the oral Torah. The discussions of the rabbis continued, not only in Palestine, but also in Babylon, and then later elsewhere. And so then finally they were codified, written down, organized, the Mishnah and Talmud. And then finally they began the basics of the prayer book and the foundations of regular prayer for the Jews. Originally 5 times a day probably, then cut down to 3 times a day, as well as the main Sabbath prayers, and especially the 18 benedictions, the main prayer that they say, a beautiful, wonderful, moving Jewish prayer. Probably the main parts of it, some early Christians prayed. So, some real moving accomplishments. Then to go on to the Christians. I did a little more with Pharisaic accomplishments because I figured they're less known. But some of the Christian accomplishments. One, they focused on God's personal involvement in human life. Even with the persecutions of the Greeks, of the Romans, God, the continuing message from Israelite times was that God had not forgotten the people of Israel. And so here's a sense, Jesus comes personally to bring God's own direct involvement and identification with our problems, with our human situation, with our struggles, religious and otherwise. Secondly, the Christian movement, whether this goes back to Jesus or is mainly Paul, as the Jewish tradition says, the Christian movement freed the Jewish religious tradition from its moorings in Torah. In other words, the Jewish religious movement could continue, and many of its main features continue. The Jewish God, the Jewish scriptures, the sense of sin and atonement, forgiveness, and relating to God. But it was not subject to Torah anymore. In other words, you did not have to become a Jew to become a Christian. You don't have to follow all the Torah. And this was admittedly the work of Paul. And then the flip side of that, third, is the Christian movement addressed all people with the claims of the Jewish God and the Jewish scripture, as mediated through the work of Jesus and the Holy Spirit. But it laid the foundations for a universal religion and a universal appeal to all people throughout the Roman Empire, which was a major accomplishment. So Christianity becomes a significant religion in its own right, and with claims to all people and the basis for becoming a missionary religion and carrying out the Great Commission. Well, this took a while to go through, but maybe you have some other comments or questions. But going back to our title, I would say, because of the liveliness of the time period, because of the variety of Jewish ways of being religious at that time, and because of the Roman threats, both political and military, this was a wide open time period. And it could have gone in several directions. And if the Jerusalem and the temple hadn't been destroyed, for instance, who knows what would have happened if the sacrificial system had continued? We don't know. And it would have had dramatic impact on all four groups, whether they survived or not, and what character and shape they took in following centuries. But in any case, what happened happened. And so two movements were lost and two continued. One stayed as a Jewish movement, and one led into what we now consider a non-Jewish movement. Well, comments, questions, anything else on your mind?
Could you talk a little bit about the conflict between the Pharisees and the Christians? I mean, that comes across very strongly in some of the Gospels, not at all in others.
Yeah.
And was that a later phenomenon around the time of the temple being destroyed?
Probably some of it goes back to Jesus' time, but New Testament scholars now are saying that after 70, the Jews and the Christians, in a sense, became rivals with each other, but also each seeking its own place and legitimacy, or to trying to keep the persecution by the Romans down. Because the Romans had the sense before 70 that to really squash the Jewish rebellion, you had to deal not only with the people and the army, you had to deal with some of the spirit that rose out of the religion. And so some Romans perceived the religion as a real threat because of its political implications. So Judaism was threatened, but also Christianity, which they perceived as coming out of the same seedbed, the religious milieu of Judaism, was a threat. So they were struggling for survival. They became competitors. And there were all kinds of varieties of either totally Jewish or totally Christian, without being Jewish, or combinations of the two. And so some Christians were still going to synagogue and practicing some forms of Judaism before the split was total between the two. And then there were some with mixed sympathies one way, sympathies the other way, and perhaps some informing to the Romans about the other groups and trying to get the Romans to persecute the others, not us. Maybe going both ways, and there are some hints of that in some of the texts. So as a result of that, by the time Matthew is written, maybe somewhere in the 80s, and John, perhaps with some early materials, but maybe not finally written, and here I'm just guessing because I don't know some of the latest New Testament scholarship, but maybe written in the 90s, at least some have thought, reflecting some of the persecution of Domitian. We see that the ways of writing up the stories of Jesus may be influenced partially by some of this later Jewish Christian rancor and dispute. And so that may have influenced the writing, because here you get into the 80s and 90s. Well, if Jesus' ministry was carried on in the late 20s and death maybe 27, 28 or whatever we're talking about, if we go from there to the 80s and the 90s, well, we're a long time beyond, and traditions were probably preserved as faithfully as possible, and also seen in the light of the continuing dispute. So Jesus' dispute with Sadducees and Pharisees and scribes becomes prototypic almost of some of the later disputes between Jews and Christians. And so it's easy to see the identification and write things up in the light of both disputes.
So some of the earlier, so Mark is pre-fall of the temple?
Perhaps, perhaps not. Some of it may go back before the time of the destruction. Final writing may come after, but there, here it's a matter of different theories.
The oral tradition also.
Yeah, I really can't go into that a whole lot, but I would say, yeah.
But Mark,
related to the, I would say just briefly and tentatively, related to the time of the destruction or before,
but Mark is one of the ones in which the Pharisees versus Jesus doesn't come off quite as much.
It comes off some, but perhaps not as personal. The Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain is in Matthew and Luke. And Jesus does emphasize, like in Mark 4, some of the Jewish usages that he says are limited. They're not absolute laws. I mean, if we're hungry and need to eat on the Sabbath or to do some work to eat on the Sabbath, we can do that. And some other things. But it doesn't have some of the stronger anti-Jewish polemics that we see in that we see in Matthew and John, for instance.
There's some tradition that Jesus, you know, the question, where was he between his bar mitzvah and his public ministry?
Yeah, 18 years of silence.
The myth is that, well, part of the myth was that he was with the Essenes in Qumran. Mm-hmm. And some of the writers on that have said it's because of his style of teaching and the images that he uses in story. I don't know how valid that is, but or was he back home making crosses or whatever he was doing? So,
or working in his dad's shop.
Right.
there's been some speculation of that. People that I'm familiar with and the writings I'm familiar with have tended to see John the Baptist more in the Essene or Qumran tradition.
Right. Coming down the wilderness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because of his emphasis on repentance and his dress and diet and place where he was preaching and severe austere message, you know, stripping life down to its basic religious essentials, which was main themes of the Essenes. And there may be some ties between Jesus and the Essenes, although some of the early Christian movement seems to have more ties, like at least the fellowship meal that they have, perhaps some type of lustration or purification that may be similar to baptism, and a few of the teachings. But from what I've read, the ties with Jesus seem to be a little more problematic.
Mm-hmm. Certainly if he's a Pharisee.
Yeah.
In terms of all of that, you know, the way he deals with the law and his own teaching.
Yeah. That seems to be pretty Pharisaic in character, much
right.
of his work.
I'm thinking of, I want to check out this out with you to make sure that I've heard you right, that the Sadducees were more assimilationist. So they were not as upset about the Hellenization of
true.
and the Essenes and Pharisees were more separatist.
The Essenes became social separatists,
right,
and physically removed themselves, right, from society.
But the Pharisees were separatist in that they wanted to have a distinct Jewish identity.
Yes, but they did participate in the life of the community. And there were some overlap between them and the Sadducees. There were a few of the more well-to-do members of the community, some of the nobles, even some Sadducees and priests who became Pharisees. And so the groups weren't totally separate memberships. And some of the big dispute that I didn't mention was really political in terms, religious and political, in terms of the membership on the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court, that was usually dominated by the Sadducees.
Right.
And the Pharisees usually had a minority membership on there. But they both participated in what was going on in society, and the Pharisees and some of their followers, from what we can tell, would make pilgrimages to Jerusalem, one if not all three annual pilgrimages, offer sacrifices and that. So it wasn't diametrically opposed. They were rivals, but sometimes more friendly and sometimes less friendly.
Did all the local regular people identify with one of those four? Or were there people?
No.
I mean, where did they connect?
There are a couple other groups that are described in some of the literature that had some sizable numbers. Now, the Essenes we know about because of the Dead Sea Scrolls, if they're the ones connected, but they were a relatively small group, quite small, become important because of the scrolls. The political activists, at least some of them, went by the name of Zealots, as well as a subgroup, perhaps, part of them, Sicarii, which were knife carriers and carrying out assassinations in the crowds and against Romans or collaborators. And they were not specially religious that we know of. They may have had some religious motivation, but they were incensed by foreign persecution of them. Just as in the rebellion and the fight against Antiochus Epiphanes, two centuries and more earlier, there were both people that were incensed for religious reasons as well as people who were incensed for nationalistic reasons. But they would join together to fight against the common enemy because they were both Jewish. And so the situation was the same in rebelling against the Romans. There were people who did that out of religious reasons. There were people that did that out of political and nationalistic reasons, seeing this as, and people that did it just because we're being persecuted out of just basic human ethical concern for the people. So those people were known and labeled mainly by their political association and by their rebellion against Rome. Then, perhaps one of the largest groups comes down in the literature is the Am Haaretz, simply the people of the land, the common people, with no other necessarily known or stated religious or political affiliation. Many of the common people probably were not that religious, and maybe not that political. Some of them were maybe business people, just hoping to do business and live in some of the cities. Others living as farmers and small merchants out in the villages and communities and on the hills farming the land and hoping to just continue a good, stable, basic life if they could. So, this doesn't. When we talk about the religious groups, that doesn't cover the spectrum. But in an attempt to do a demographic survey, it's pretty difficult because we don't have numbers and facts and figures. And we have these movements that are referred to in some of the literature, And we know that there are, that they existed, but what percentage of people, statistics that we'd like to see today, we don't have available.
Among those groups, where would you, do we have any guess about Joseph and Mary?
About?
Joseph and Mary, Jesus' parents?
Probably influenced by some local rabbis. Seemingly an observant Jewish family, maybe mildly observant.
Okay.
Upstanding, according to the birth story in Matthew, when Joseph finds that Mary's pregnant, rather than cause a scandal, he's going to put her away quietly or divorce her quietly, because part of the tradition was that you're engaged or betrothed for a year before you get married, but to break a betrothal, it also calls for a formal divorce. Mm-hmm. But rather than cause her to be publicly shamed, he was going to do that privately according to the traditions available to him. And evidently some religious sensitivities that Jesus picked up from them about their religious traditions, which if Jesus picked them up from him and identified with some of the work of the Pharisees and some of the teachers, probably got them from their own interest along those lines, but pretty speculative.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
That's for me.
Oh, one book I could mention in the bookstore. I brought this along. Our Father Abraham, Jewish Roots of Our Christian Faith by Marvin Wilson. It was used by a fellow who was here last year, who evidently was Jewish and converted and became Lutheran. And it has some good materials. I just had a chance to glance at it before the class, and so you might find it helpful if you'd like to look at it. It tells in a different way some of the history and religious backgrounds that we were talking about.